The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. And welcome to our library. I'm Ed Rosen, and I've been given the distinct honor of welcoming you to the Philadelphia Free Library and of introducing our distinguished writer and guest. And just so it shouldn't be a total shock to anybody, please turn off and don't turn on and, you know, the usual routine so that Dr. Sacker won't be interrupted by electronic messages from outer space. My pleasure this evening is to introduce Dr. Sacker and to welcome him back to the Philadelphia Free Library. He spoke here, he is not exactly sure how many years ago, but he spoke here about 20-some years ago, and I think he introduced his most successful book. That is, of course, up until tonight. So you should know that Dr. Sacker is Professor Emeritus of Modern History and International Affairs at George Washington University and the author of a great many praised, highly praised, histories of Jewish life, modern Israel, the Zionist movement, and the Middle East. Dr. Sacker told me that he doesn't consider himself a Jewish historian, but rather a European historian, because his expertise, of course, is in a wide area of international history. He is a consultant and lecturer on Middle Eastern affairs for various governmental bodies, and heaven knows they do need consultants, including the United States Foreign Service Institute, and he has served as a guest lecturer at Hebrew University, Tel Aviv University, and Johns Hopkins University. Among his erudite and engaging histories are A History of Israel, A History of the Jews in America, which he confided in me as his most successful book, Farewell España, and Israel in Europe. He is also editor of a 39-volume, The Rise of Israel, a documentary history, which the library director, Elliot Shelcrott, has told me he has read in detail and is willing to take a test on it. The winner of two National Book Awards, Professor Sacker's books are consistently praised for their breadth, scholarship, and readability. In his new book, A History of the Jews in the Modern Age, Professor Sacker traces the history of Jews from the 18th century to the present, covering the two poles of modern Jewish history, the collective catastrophe of persecution leading to the Holocaust during World War II, and the political and social freedoms offered by modernity's emphasis on education, social mobility, and individual success. The result is a rich and balanced account of the emergence of Jews as important contributors in the worlds of commerce, culture, science, and politics, and also as victims of vicious and at times murderous anti-Semitism. It is with great pleasure on your behalf that I welcome to this podium Dr. Howard Sacker. Dr. Sacker. I know he's here somewhere.
Well, Mr. Rosen, you've deprived me of the pleasure of hearing your introduction, but I assume from the applause that it was felicitous, and I'm grateful. I'm even more grateful to be invited to this distinguished library series yet again. I the first and only time when I was here. It was, I think, 35, 37 years ago, when in my early middle age. And I'm fully cognizant of the quality of the authors whom you invite, although your repertoire has increased exponentially since then, and I think largely due to the imagination and spade work of Mr. Andy Kahan, whose knowledgeability and fervent hard work in this field, I don't think bears an analog anywhere in my experience. But I tell you very frankly that I'm even more grateful for the compliment paid the subject that I am about to address, the subject of modern Jewish history. I indicated in the preface to The Late Unpleasantness that I authored that the scholarship devoted to this subject has increased explosively in the last 50 years. I regard that as an increase which is a logical increase, because notwithstanding their very modest demography, the Jews have functioned not only as the anvil for other larger, richer, more powerful nations, they have generated a formidable muscularity in their own right. And whether in economics or in politics or in culture or in diplomacy or, regrettably lately, even in warfare, their role over the past three centuries looms dramatically out of proportion to their modest critical mass. Not to worry, I don't expect this evening to discuss every dimension of that muscularity, let alone their vulnerability, but for the occasion of a library address and for the sophisticated intellectuals who are part of the audience, anyone can see it, that for this occasion, I think it perhaps is most appropriate to focus on just one single aspect of the Jew in modern times. And it is the impact of this little people on the culture of modern Europe. And I enjoy embarking upon this subject by invoking a fascinating novel written in 1926 by a Viennese Protestant named Hugo Bettauer. The Protestant name, although he was born Jewish, was Die Stadt ohne Juden, the city without Jews. And it was a thinly veiled satire, a Romana Clef, if you like, on the turn-of-the-century mayor of Vienna, named Karl Weger, and not incidentally on the poisonous anti-Semitism that characterized Viennese society in those days. For the purposes of the novel, the Weger takes the form of a chancellor of the Habsburg Empire, and he steps before the Reichsrat, the upper house of the Austrian Parliament, with a very interesting proposition. It's a piece of legislation that he proposes to this parliament. He said, "We have to expel the Jews of Vienna due to their domination, with their uncannily keen intelligence, their worldliness and freedom from tradition. They overpowered us, became our masters, and gained the upper hand in all our economic and spiritual and cultural life." And with glee, the Parliament passed that legislation, and the Jews of Vienna about 250,000 in those days, were given, I think, 6 months to vacate the country, and they did. But what happened in the wake of their departure? What happened to their businesses? What happened to their properties that the chancellor coveted for 100% Austrians? Well, these devolved not into the hands of native Gentiles, but into the hands of foreign banks. And more disastrous and unexpected still was the consequence to Vienna's professional life. The press, largely dominated by Jewish journalists and editors, devolved into local screeds due to the absence of Jewish journalists and Jewish editors. The courtrooms became hopelessly clogged because of the lack of Jewish attorneys. The concert halls, the theaters, they closed because of the absence of Jewish musicians and conductors and directors and producers. The clinics and the hospitals became altogether dysfunctional because of the absence of Jewish doctors. The bookstores, the publishing houses, for lack of proprietors and specifically for lack of clientele, atrophied and closed. And in the end, the Chancellor and Parliament were obliged to reverse themselves and to pass a piece of legislation welcoming the Jews back home. And the book ends, by the way, with thousands of Jews traipsing back to their native Vienna to the tumultuous cheers of the awaiting Gentile population in Austria. Well, actually, this fascinating little novel was an aperçu into European circumstances. Because by 1900, and certainly by the eve of Hitler, Jewish participation in the continent's cultural life was altogether preeminent. There was no field in which Jews were not active. Leading musicians, scientists, humanists, professors. There were reasons for this, and part of the reasons were purely functional. The professions were an opportunity for Jews to be self-employed and free from the lingering whims and prejudices of Gentile employers. And there was another reason. The middle class of Vienna were particularly sentient to the opportunities of professional life because there would not be any competition from the aristocracy. The aristocracy chose to dominate the government, dominate the church, dominate the army. And thus, the world of culture, the world of the professions, by and large, was left to the middle class. And of all the members of the middle class, those paradigmatic bourgeoisie, the Jews, filled the vacuum with the greatest alacrity. For example, there was a Jewish intellectual tradition with this little people built upon. It was not always so, by the way. In biblical times, the Jews were a people of faith, not of intellect, not of skepticism. That was the gift of the Hellenistic world. But by the time of the Middle Ages, by the time the Jews became a demographic fact of life in Europe, they were dominated by a very, very complex corpus juris named the Talmud. And you couldn't be a knowledgeable Jew, even a identified Jew, without having mastered this complex of rules and regulations. And the Jews studied from morning to night in this avocation of the Talmud. They starved themselves. They forswore even their domestic life, because they often sent their wives to run the business, where they attended the yeshiva and studied the Talmud. And this tradition of intellectualism, learning a vast legal complex tradition, was, after a while, translated into secular terms, and especially in modern times, when the instinct for perhaps religion began to wane in the age of materialism. And it still persists. I think it accounts for the fact that a prize catch for the daughter of a middle-class Jewish family is still a doctor or a lawyer or a rabbi, even a poor professor. Even the Jewish millionaires of the most distinguished lineages, when they exhausted their instinct for accumulating wealth, they somehow managed to lapse back into the world of intellect. And in this fashion, a Rothschild would become a world-renowned ornithologist. A Warburg would become an art historian. A Cassirer would become a philosopher. A Sassoon would become a poet. This is typical of the thousands of Jewish businessman's sons who fled from the clamorous retreat of the market into the genteel retreat of intellect. As I see it, the world of Jewish intellect was characterized by certain specific, if you like, innovations. And one of these innovations was the plight of innovation itself. Because the Jews, in a minority, nevertheless were pioneers of more areas of intellectual life than perhaps we realize today. They, not all of them, were intellectual giants. Not all of them certainly were pioneers. Not all of them were revolutionaries. But I think a case can be made that proportionately they were world shakers, more than their counterparts in the non-Jewish world. I think of the realm of music, dominated by the leitmotif of pure aestheticism, either in the age of classicism or the age of romanticism, but not dominated by the realm of ideas. And it was really given to the conductor of the Philharmonic Opera Orchestra of Vienna, a man by the name of Gustav Mahler, to create of the symphony an arena for a vast evocation of ideas and sentiments and emotions. In Mahler's music, for example, you see the innocence of childhood, all the way up to the elegiac sadness of impending death. He was, in his late life, he was influenced too by a master of new form, a pioneer of musical formula, a self-educated former bank clerk by the name of, well, you have heard of him, by the name of Schoenberg. Arnold Schoenberg. Schoenberg was the inventor of the 12-tone formula, which revolutionized the technique of tonality, and he opened up techniques for Shostakovich and Benjamin Britten and Aaron Copland and Leonard Bernstein. We don't know modern music, and certainly the modern music which we see on Broadway or musicals, except for that man's protean influence. In the world of drama, there was a man named Otto Brahm, nay, Abrahamson, who introduced single-handedly Ibsenian realism to the German-speaking stage. He wrote, he produced, he directed so many plays in this genre that he almost single-handedly steered Ibsenian realism to its triumph in Central Europe. But Otto Brahm would have achieved, I think, immortality for himself if only for his discovery of a young actor, playwright, producer who actually surpassed the master. And this was a man named Max Reinhardt, who was single-handedly really the author of the most illustrious period of the German and Hungarian theater. In 1920s and the 1930s, Reinhard infused orthodox realism, naturalism, with a sensual, versatile style, mastering all the arts of dance and music and pantomime and painting and architecture. He introduced the tiny circle theater of the Japanese and the all-dimensional theater circuses of the Russians. He nurtured so many proteges to fame in Austria and Hungary that they were his students. So many of them, in fact, that the Central European stage between about 1910 and 1933 was as Jewish as Broadway has been until this day. If we were to explore the world of science, I think we all are familiar with the fact that Newtonian's conceptions of a mechanical universe dominated that field of physics and mathematics until the advent of a young Swiss patent inspector by the name of Albert Einstein, who established the most fundamental scientific premises of the 20th century, perhaps the most important of which was the theory of relativity. I'm tempted to explain to this audience the theory of relativity, but I see that time does not quite permit. But it is important to note that even Einstein had his Jewish predecessors. Hermann Minkowski, the mathematician who established the four-dimensional time continuum, which was used by Einstein in his experiments. Tullio Levi Civita devised the absolute calculus, which was the instrument used by Einstein in his discoveries. Albert Michelson, who devised the Morley-Michelson experiment, disproved ether as the medium for light rays. When Einstein published his seminal theories in the Archive for Physics, they were first interpreted in Germany by Max Born and in the United States by Leon Silberstein. So many Jewish physicists identified with Einstein's new approach that the Nazis contemptuously dubbed it Judenphysik, and they resented it as a revolt against the old truth, the old truths and the old verities of German science. Well, what can we ascribe this genius for innovation to? I don't think it can be ascribed to the religious identification of Jews. That, by the way, was the theory of a very famous European economist by the name of Werner Sombart. He said that the Jews invented capitalism because of their biblical background and their expertise in business and their list of do's and don'ts and the permission that they had in medieval times to apply interest to the loans. And this was verified by the Bible, and so the Jews were the inventors of modern capitalism. Notwithstanding the presence at the same time of the Protestants. But this was the theory of Werner Sombart, and it doesn't hold water. It was the theory of another man, a very talented man in most instances, that the simplest answer to the Jewish productivity, the Jewish genius for innovation, was attributed to their race. They had suffered so much because of their race and religion in ancient times, in medieval times, even in modern times, that nature winnowed their critical mass. And the survival of the fittest, of course, would be the world-famous geniuses that they were. No, that doesn't hold water, too. When Jews were persecuted most malevolently in history, by and large, they were least productive intellectually. When thinks of the period of mysticism and Kabbalism and false messiahs, almost invariably these episodes were at the tail end of some traumatic persecution that drove Jews from pillar to post. I think the simplest answer to this Jewish passion for innovation was the answer to the B'nai B'rith Lodge of Vienna, which had congratulated Sigmund Freud on his 70th birthday. It was in 1926. And he wrote a letter of thanks to the B'nai B'rith Lodge, and he gave this simple answer: "Only to my Jewish nature did I owe the two qualities that had been indispensable to me on my hard road. Because I was a Jew, I found myself free from many prejudices that limited others in the use of their intellect, and being a Jew, I was prepared to enter opposition and to renounce agreement with the compact majority." And I think this is a penetrating insight. The same minority status that divorced Jews from feudal land law and ecclesiastical loyalties, that impelled them to be mobile and experimental and successful businessmen, at the same time liberated them from the intellectual dogmas and prejudices of the compact majority. It enabled and it forced the Jews to view the world, to probe the universe, the minds, the bodies, the folk mores of their Christian neighbors with a freedom from tradition and inhibition that was not typical or necessary for their Christian neighbors. I discern a second characteristic of Jewish cultural activity in modern times. And here we find an interesting clue in the concentration of Jews in medicine. Obviously, there are vocational reasons. It offered self-employment. It offered the opportunity for a certain financial security. But that by itself would not explain the fact that 25% of Jewish doctors in Prussia, the largest state in modern Germany, in Prussia, forswore the remunerative opportunities of private practice for salaried research, which was much less grandiose in its rewards. And their names, even today, read like a roll call of medical history. Friedrich Cohen, the founder of bacteriology, Moritz Schiff, the founder of endocrinology, Pulitzer and Barani, the founders of otology, the diseases of the ear, Waldemar Hofkein, who discovered the anti-cholera vaccine as a research scientist, Otto Warburg, who discovered the metastatic metabolism of cancer, Albert Frankel, who isolated the micrococci of pneumonia, Casimir Funk, who discovered vitamins. And this, in addition to the countless diagnostic and surgical techniques pioneered by Jewish scientists. As I read it, one factor accounting for this sunburst was the prestige with which Jewish tradition endowed the medical profession. And here I can't avoid alluding to the central meaning of Jewish religious sociology. It was, in a nutshell, the sanctification of life. The sanctification of life on earth, unlike the indifference to life that was characteristic of the pagan world. The sanctification of life on earth as distinguished from the emphasis on the world to come, which was current in the Christian tradition. The reverence for life which was evinced in the countless injunctions covering the most prosaic and even pedestrian factors of contemporary life. You know, it's not an accident that in the medieval world, the course in medicine was part of the curriculum of the rabbinical yeshivot. And if you want to know who was the greatest Jewish religious philosopher in medieval times, he was also the greatest doctor. All right. You're quick on the upbeat. It was Maimonides. In more modern times, admittedly, Jewish doctors, like their Christian counterparts, were not responding to this religious impulse. But the tradition that venerated the man who could save life made a vocation that was a dignified one among Christians a uniquely prestigious one among Jews. And it was mainly among Jews that the majority of Jewish doctors would be living. I'm tempted to go off into a field which was the literal invention and monopoly of Jewish doctors almost into modern times. In fact, I think it even holds today. I open the floor to a guess. It was psychiatry. It was invented by a Jew. It was dominated by Jews. It, until this day, in the United States at least, is practiced more by Jews, even quantitatively, as well as qualitatively and proportionately. And I think that there were reasons for this extraordinary symbiosis of Jews in the world of psychoanalysis. It was the unconscious desire of Jews themselves as social outcasts to unmask the fraudulent respectability of the European society that closed them out. And what better way of accomplishing this feat than by dredging up from the human psyche the sordid and the infantile sexual aberrations that were the authentic cause of Christian misbehavior. Even non-psychiatrists enjoyed the feat of social equalization that was performed by Freud's new thinking. You see the contrast, for example, between the reaction of the Vienna Medical Society when he read before them his three essays in infantile sexuality. And the chairman of the society became redder and redder and redder, and before long he screamed at the top of his voice, "This is a matter for the police!" And they blackballed Freud. But the B'nai B'rith Lodge of Vienna loved him, loved to hear his theories and the feat of social equalization that these theories performed. I don't say that was the only reason, of course. It was not only a desire to unmask, but to cure. And I suggest that it reflected the exceptional sensitivity of Jews to the psychic pain of their patients. Is it such a stretch to suggest that a minority people, plagued by every variety of personal and social insecurity, of frustrations, would be capable of greater empathy with the insecurities and the frustrations of others? The Jews developed a unique capacity for understanding the sources of emotional suffering in others. And this sensitivity, together with Jewish veneration of life and the lifesaver, was one of the most noteworthy characteristics of Jewish intellectualism. I think I see a third and perhaps last thread running through the phenomenon of Jewish cultural influence in modern times. You are familiar, I'm sure, with the mastery the Jews gained in European belles lettres, certainly by the turn of the 20th century. And that mastery reached its zenith in probably the 1920s and even the early 1930s. Certainly between 1900 and the advent of Hitler, Jewish belletrists, literateurs, essayists, critics were the most penetrating interpreters of European culture. And perhaps they fulfilled thereby a classic interpretive role which was expected from outsiders. Europeans expected this of their Jews. It precluded the need for inventing Chinese or Persian visitors, that device, you remember, that was used in the 18th century Enlightenment when these mythical figures from the Far East were parachuted into Western Europe and to give judgment or render judgment on the peculiarities and the foibles and the peccadilloes of these strange Western Europeans. Well, the Jews were there to perform that task for them. Not all Jewish intellectuals hewed to the role of acerbic outsiders. There were no more typically English playwrights than Henry Arthur Jones or Arthur Wing Pinero. There were no more authentic Parisian boulevardiers than Alfred Philippe de Nahonnery or Henri Bernstein, the founder of the Comédie Française. And yet, in the case of these, you see the almost self-conscious preoccupation with being cosmopolitans by seeing and judging European society as a whole. When thinks of the dean of European literatures, Stefan Zweig, he was by all accounts the most renowned man of letters in the 20th century. And the hobby and the fixation of this man for collecting mementos of Mozart and Beethoven, of his native Austria, but also of Blake and of England and Claudel and Roland in France, and his preoccupation with not appearing provincial. He said, "We of all people must be objective in our judgment rendered on the creative minds of all the wings of Europe." I think, too, of Ernst Lissauer. He was the exact opposite of Stefan Zweig. He wrote the Hymn of Hate against England, the single most vitriolic marching song of the German army. He was personally decorated by the Kaiser for it because he had to prove his Germanism, his patriotism, and that was a scandal for his fellow European intellectuals. And one of them, by the way, was an intellectual manqué. His name was Walter Rathenau. He was an industrialist. He was the chairman of the equivalent of the General Electric Corporation in Germany. Later he became a diplomat and even one of Germany's first foreign ministers in the Weimar Republic. But he was a businessman with a conscience, and he wrote 12 books emphasizing the approach of compassion and resilience and flexibility and equity in dealing with workers. And he pronounced and proclaimed a new social dogma for Europe that in certain respects anticipated the welfare state. I think it was for this reason, no less as for his diplomacy, that it became a bad word in the eyes of the rightists of Germany. Count Harry Kessler, a non-Jewish nobleman in Germany, was a very good friend of Walter Rathenau and a very perceptive friend. And he wrote of him later on, "Somewhere within him, Rathenau, fear lurked as his basic instinct, a lack of self-confidence deepened by the fact that he was a Jew, and he had to promote and expatiate on this inheritance by his worldly view of Europe, his unprejudiced view of the way of classes, the way of class harmony, equity in dealing with the lower classes. "Oh, I'm not going to deny my origin," said a compatriot of the celebrated Walter Rathenau. This was Jacques de La Cartel. He was an Alsatian, and he made France his home after the Great War. And he left us a memorable aperçu of a Jewish schoolmate, which he called Silberman. Probably that wasn't his real name. And he quoted Silberman. "Oh, I'm not going to deny my origin," said Silberman. "Only I want to farm the genius of my race according to the tradition of Europe. I don't want it to be said of anything that I write, there is a Frenchman, there is a Jew. I prefer that they call it a European. I don't want to be parochial." And there wasn't a parochialism that distinguished the Jews of 20th century Europe. One example of this was the interesting career of the major literary critics in 20th century Europe. I mentioned one of them, the great Stefan Zweig, but there were others as well. And one of the others was a man named Moritz Cohen, better known by his nom de plume of, well, he was the greatest critic of Western Europe. He introduced the literature of Eastern Europe. What am I referring to? He's known to history as Georges Brandes. And Georges Brandes, by common definition, was the dean of Western European literature, criticism. He was the first to introduce Polish literature and Russian literature into Western Europe. And afterwards, Albert Kerr, who was the dean of Berlin drama critics, introduced all the plays of Chekhov and Tolstoy and Pushkin and the poetry of these people. And he was a polymath. He translated these into four European languages and almost in one fell swoop cosmopolitanized the culture of Western Europe. The Jewish art collectors in Western Europe were the first to purchase the works of foreign artists. The Jewish bibliophiles were the first to buy the books of foreign authors. The art dealers of Western Europe were the first to lend a hand to budding talents, even if those talents did not pan out. And by the way, the only art dealers that were willing to buy the early etchings and paintings of a ne'er-do-well hobo who lived in the streets of Vienna before the 1914, his name was Adolf Hitler, were Jewish art dealers. "Whoever wished to put something frou in Vienna," said Thomas Mann, "or had come to Vienna as a guest from abroad and sought appreciation as well as an audience, was dependent on the Jewish bourgeoisie. They wined and dined me. They bought my books. They wrote reviews of my books. They made me." Whatever they felt about Judaism as a religion, Jewish writers recognized the historic role of the Jew as cosmopolitan, as an extranational influence. And it's no accident, ladies and gentlemen, that as late as the First World War, the International Union of Intellectuals was founded in Switzerland by the Czech Jew Franz Werfel and the Austrian Jew Stefan Zweig. Nor on the eve of that war, the Anglo-Jewish banker Sir Ernst Castell and the Hamburg maritime tycoon Freiherr Albert Behlen were the private emissaries who were sponsored by their governments to try to find a solution to the assassination in Sarajevo and the impending apocalypse which portended over Europe. They were not successful, but they were instinctively applied to because they were the only internationals who spoke presumably the same language. By the way, in October of 1918, the Kaiser's government sent out its first armistice overtures through the conduit of the German Zionist Federation. Well, not more than a generation after the First World War, Nazi Germany signed the death warrant for European Jewry, and the end came with indiscriminate speed and violence for the bourgeois Jews of Western Europe and the proletarian Jews of Poland and Russia, for the rich and the poor and the gifted and the unendowed, for the good and the bad. By any except the Nazi yardstick, there could be no hierarchy of value for lives of human beings. Each Jew was a creature of memories and aspirations, of divine potentialities, of animal weaknesses, of the good and the bad. From the Jewish viewpoint, no one of its people was more expendable than another. But from the viewpoint of the people of Europe, the Christian people of Europe, it was the loss of the Jewish intelligentsia that was to be felt most keenly of all. European culture on the eve of Hitler was indissolubly, irrefragably interpenetrated by Jewish intellect. That world of literature and art and science and music and scholarship, that humane and civilized world which was the eternal pride and glory of the European and his last refuge whence political and military and economic strength had failed. No one in that world could forswear its Jewish intelligentsia. They had to have them, and they couldn't afford the loss of this gifted sunburst of intellect, of the intellectual courage of Sigmund Freud, or the galactic insights of Albert Einstein, the stylistic delicacy of Arthur Schnitzler, or the fire and the passion of Stefan Zweig. Europe needed them all. The distinguished conductor, the amateur musician, the erudite university philosopher, and the civilized and urbane conversationalist in a coffee shop, the imaginative scientist who dealt with theories in a classroom, and the dedicated doctor who dealt with emergencies in a sick room. When the hour for their eradication came, no chancellor, Hugo Bettauer-like, would ever again be able to legislate their return. I said in the beginning of my remarks that I am familiar with this marvelous library. Even as a student in the little Quaker college that I attended not many miles from here, I remember I couldn't ever finish my major term papers without access to the revered Central Library of Philadelphia. And I see people who are its docents, the people who are intellectually and emotionally wedded to the preservation and enlargement of this esteemed institution. I think I know what that is. You want your children and your grandchildren to have access to the best books, the best knowledge that Western civilization can provide. Well, if your children and grandchildren avail themselves of the opportunities which revered libraries like this one provide. I hope, too, that the spirit of Freud and Kafka and Proust and Feuchtwanger and other of that rare constellation will peer over their shoulders. I think they will not only profit from the knowledge that lies between the covers of those books, but I think they will absorb the spirit and the ideals of this Jewish intellectual sunburst, the ideal of innovation, a willingness to pioneer new concepts, to break with outworn modes and worns of tradition, and pioneer new concepts without fear of inhibition or censure. The ideal, if not of alienation, of its doppelganger, which was universalism, an awareness that sensitive spirits are to be found in every land and every culture, and awareness that parochialism is not only anti-intellectual, but verges on moral suicide. But I think, above all, the ideal of compassion, which was the mortar of Europe's most enduring cultural monuments, of healing, of empathy for the disfranchised and the poor and the ill, and the preoccupation with the divinity of all living creatures. It is a prophetic heritage, this legacy of an ancient people's sanctification of life.
Well, I'm delighted, and I know you'll be pleased as well, that Dr. Saker will be happy to answer questions. We have volunteers on each side with microphones, and we want to be sure that everyone can hear. So if you would raise your hand, we will get a microphone to you right away. Please raise your hand if you have a question. The woman right here in the middle. Keep your hand up higher. I think this is the closer microphone. Well, whichever. Okay. And then we're going to come up to the front here.
Thank you so much for what I view as a much healthier theory of Jewish history than the Lagrimos theory, which still reigns today so strongly. Why, and is there a role for that as well?
Why is that? I see. Well, I'll tell you, it doesn't depend on the Jews alone. They did have access to Western education, and even to Eastern education, at least in times of tolerance in 19th and early 20th century Russia. And it would be disingenuous to suggest that Jews simply sprung, formed from the brow of Zeus, or that just generated from the bowels of the earth as geniuses, as writers, as scientists, as musicians. Obviously, they had help. And that help was supremely that access to education. I'll tell you that when the schools began opening up to Jews in Western and Central Europe by the middle of the 19th century, and certainly thereafter, no people gravitated almost in a rictus of a biological tropism to that opportunity of their education more avidly than did to the Jews. I think I have explained some of the reasons, functional reasons like the opportunity as professionals to be self-employed, but even more, the opportunity to recapitulate a primordial urge that was central to the Jewish tradition since the Middle Ages. And by the way, I think that symbiosis of intellect, or if you like, culture, and the Jewish minority is beginning to fade. But in this country, much more than it had in Europe, if they gravitate to degrees today, like my own children, they're going to gravitate to business school far more than the medical school or even law school, because the compulsions and the impulsions that were current in the marginal and peripheral Europe, the Jewish Europe of the 19th and early 20th century, are gradually fading. And I have made my peace with this denouement. My children will not be brilliant scholars. They'll just be millionaires, and I'll live with the fact. I'll live with the fact.
Okay. We have a question right here, and then I see there is then somebody way in the back, and then we'll go over to this side again.
Dr. Sacker, you said that Europe could not do without its intellectual Jews, and yet they were either destroyed or they came to this country or Great Britain. I guess it's a two-part question. If the intellectual Jew was so much a part and so needed and so desired, why didn't there are lots of answers to this, I suppose, but what is your answer? Why didn't Europe stand up for its intelligentsia?
Why anti-Semitism? Why the Holocaust? I don't think it was jealousy. And I don't think it was the explosion of the virulent mania that was Hitler's Nazism was characteristic of Jewish history. By and large, in earlier ages, the persecution of Jews, the active persecution, the massacres, the forced expulsions, were not directed to Jews alone. If you remember, for example, it was the Crusades and the reconquest of Spain by the Christians that had the Muslim as the principal enemy. The Jews were the most vulnerable minority of non-believers, of infidels that were close at hand. And when nationalistic hysteria was exacerbated in the period of the reconquest of Spain or the Crusades in Europe, by and large, all these armies, all these swordsmen, all these fanatics simply did not neglect the most helpless minority that was closest to hand as part of the larger crusade against an alien civilization, which in those days was a Muslim civilization. What occasioned the first ghetto in Rome? Was it specifically an anti-Jewish prejudice? Well, that was not lacking, to be sure. But this was the heyday of the Counter-Reformation. And the epic wars that took place in Europe were between Protestants and Catholics. And these wars were not ended. One of them lasted for 30 years. And as you know, they were not ended with any finality. Europe remained divided between the two host cultures. And the Jew was ghettoized, marginalized, by and large, during that period, because he was the easiest and most vulnerable minority at hand. And by the way, the years thereafter were years not of unremitting persecution and marginalism. There was an improvement in Jewish circumstances. And in my latest and pleasantest, I tried to discuss that. Even at the beginning, in the 17th century, for example, of the approximately 30 universities that were functioning in Europe, Jews made up 10% of the students, even then. The medical school of the University of Jena, as early as 1720, had a Jewish majority in his medical school. And I agree with the previous questioner when I say that the Jews of Europe were not the victims of an altogether lachrymose history, not remotely. Even in the days when the ghetto was the lot of the Jews, first of all, they didn't levitate with desire to intermingle with Christian culture in the West, and certainly not with Slavic culture in Eastern Europe. These people were far inferior intellectually to them, and even economically. What was the average lot of the average Christian as late as the 17th century? I remember a description of Jacques de la Barrière. He was a kind of de Tocqueville of 17th century and early 18th century France as he toured the farmsteads and the countryside of Western Europe. And he said, these are not human beings. They are brute animals. They live in caves. They live in the most miserable hovels. They have black bread, if they're fortunate, and water to drink one time a day for their major meal. And if they stand erect, I think that they even bear the lineaments of human beings, but I'm not sure. The Jews' life was better than the average Christian life in the earliest years of the modern era. And you ought to remember that the Jews were spared the most single debilitating, the single most horrid fate of all Christians in the Ancien Régime. They didn't have to go to war. They were exempt from the armies because they were exempt from the feudal system of Europe, which was based upon the oath of liege loyalty, which was a Christian oath, and they couldn't take it.
Some other questions? Yes.
Professor Sacker, thank you for the extraordinary breadth of your tour through Western intellectual history and Jewish influence, which I assume extends across the Atlantic. I was wondering how you would fit the Marx brothers into this history.
I refuse to answer an audience that would have me as the speaker. The Marx Brothers were archetypical of the Jewish role in entertainment in the 20th century. The world of entertainment was very largely a Jewish world in the advent of the 20th century because it was a profession, or an avocation, if you can call it that, that Christians shunned. It was faintly disrespectable. It was an alien, unrespectable vocation for a peripheral people. And the Jews, as in Europe, gravitated to it as their main chance. It wasn't even in the United States, by the way, that this phenomenon was apparent. The Jews were the pioneer of the movie industry in Germany, too. And they ran the biggest studios and were the most famous directors of the German movie industry. I spoke of the stage, and I'll not embellish upon that presentation, but a man named Ernst Lubitsch, for example, became the paradigm of European film comedy. And eventually he came to these shores well before the advent of Nazism to become the master of the Lubitsch touch and really one of the greatest directors in Hollywood. And, of course, the refugee artists that came here in the 30s replicated his feat. If you're interested in pursuing that subject a little more at length, I go into it rather deeply in a previous book, The History of the Jews of the United States, and Hollywood and Broadway figure prominently in that account.
Okay, we have time for a couple more questions. There we go. There's a person in the back, and then we'll come over here towards the front.
Dr. Sacker, there's one thing that's always bothered me. Anti-Semitism, as I understand it, is frequently referred in historical circles, maybe in psychological circles, as the great hatred. And what I find interesting in that is that here you have a situation where a small group of people have been persecuted for 2,000 years with only minimal improvement, and the sociologists say nothing about it, the political scientists say nothing about it, the psychologists say nothing about it. I'm wondering if you could comment on the lack of, I don't know what a good way to phrase this, but the lack of telling the truth, which involves Christianity, in the 2,000-year persecution of a small group of people.
Well, I'll tell you, you're right. Certainly one of the important and most lethal wellsprings of Jew hatred was to be found in church doctrine and church practice. But in an age of rationalism and materialism, which I discuss in the modern period, these influences, I don't say they began to wane. They didn't. Pope Pius XII, I think, is a testament to that grim fact. But it wasn't the only ingredient, and by then it was not the most important ingredient. By the late 19th century, and certainly the 20th century, ethnic exorcism, an ethnic trauma, was the main feature that fastened on the Jews as the expendable people of Europe. But not only in the Jews. In Eastern Europe, it was not only the Jews, it was the Gypsies and the Poles and the Catholics in Tsarist Russia. And I venture to predict, too, that this phenomenon is coming back in the Russia of post-communist Soviet Union, and we see very sinister prefigurations of that phenomenon even today. But by and large, I think it was modern pseudoscience, the Aryan theory, the clash of ethnicities, and the horrible ups and downs of the European economy that were so much more spectacular and so much more traumatic than in the age of pre-industrial Europe that has exacerbated these factors and made people like you as chronically pessimistic as you view the Jewish present and perhaps the Jewish future, as we all are. But, you know, living on the edge is a self-fulfilling prophecy. it becomes a fixation, a neurosis, and if it becomes calamitous enough, and you see symptoms of that in the literature of Jews, even of American Jews today, and certainly in works like Philip Roth's, you'll understand that we don't gain anything by it, by living on eggs and acting as if we are self-vaccinating ourselves, because if we expect catastrophe at any moment, then when it comes, presumably we will not fall into shock. We don't run our families that way. We don't run our businesses that way. And it's not right, I think, and it's even self-defeating to run our brains and our psyches that way.
We have one more question here, and then we're going to have to go upstairs. Oh.
Which one?
Well, I did not see the woman's hand there. I'm sorry.
Professor.
Yes, madam.
If you were to write an addendum to your book today in the context of current events, would you share some of your observations with us, please, since the publication?
Would I share what?
Some of your observations in terms of the current situation of the Jews in the modern world in terms of current events.
Well, as I told the intellectual elite with whom I was privileged to sup this evening, it's a mixed bag. I end my book, this current manuscript, with a grim prediction that in Europe, almost paradoxically, the state that was to have normalized the Jewish condition, the state of Israel, is not really fulfilling that job. It used to. For the first 20, 25 years of Israel's existence, it redounded favorably on Jews, not only in Israel, but indeed in Europe as well. But when Israel evinced the characteristics of other states and was not found to be inevitably and in all circumstances a perfect surrogate for Christian imperfections, then, perhaps in the sense of anticlimax, the Europeans said, maybe we have invested in the wrong surrogate, and we will deal with the Jews as we deal with any people. And if they are competition, or if they are malefactors, or if they present themselves as indiscriminate supporters of Israel, perhaps we may evaluate the exalted status and the exalted passions and goodwill that we once rendered them. And I think this is a very serious danger, and I think we are witnessing the phenomenon even today. But you cannot say it is a universal phenomenon, because some of the countries in Europe with the guiltiest consciences are the best friends not only of Jews, but the best friends and indispensable supporters of the State of Israel. Which country among all the countries of Europe, by the way, is playing that role? It's Germany. A few weeks ago, I was invited to participate with Fritz Stern. I understand he's going to be your speaker in the future. Wonderful man. And the occasion was the celebration of the opening of the Center for Judaic Civilization at the Free University of Berlin. And it was magnanimously supported, first of all, by the Land government of Berlin, and I think even one of the other states of Western Europe, of Western Germany. It is municipally backrolled, and it's a very impressive phenomenon. If you go to the Museum of Modern German History on the Museum Isle of Berlin, you will see the most horrific exposé of Nazi persecution and the operation of death camps. I think if I have not seen anything like it even in this country, let alone any state in Europe. And it's in the Purgis's Museum in Berlin, the Museum of German Culture. This people has a guilt complex that is unsurpassed, and it's to Israel's benefit and the Jews of Germany's benefit. And by the way, what is the second largest Jewish population on the continent of Europe, of Western Europe today? It's Germany, second largest. The first largest is France, but the second largest is Germany. 120,000 Russian emigres have settled not in Israel or in the United States, but in Germany. And the Germans don't feel comfortable in imposing immigration restraints on them. And if you add that to the 80,000 Jews of pre-Soviet, pre-so-called free Russia, you have in Germany today a Jewish population of about 210,000. And I assure you, they're not sitting on their suitcases any longer in a paroxysm of insecurity. They are an integral part of the social scene in Germany. You cannot generalize of any time, of any country. The circumstances will wane and wax and vary throughout all of history and certainly throughout all of Jewish history.
Thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, let's please join us upstairs, buy a copy of the book, and get it signed. We'll see you upstairs.
Excellent. Well, thank you. I used to be better, but I had to operate.
Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.